Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our city, as we all know, does not have a large enough stock of affordable housing or workforce housing to meet the need. Some of that can be blamed on Charlotte's success and on rising property values leading to gentrification. Some can be blamed on decisions city planners made in the past. So what to do about that? Voters and businesses have stepped up with a total of $100 million. To help restore, retain, and build new housing units, and reporter Pam Kelly, in partnership with the Charlotte Journalism Collaborative, has been searching for solutions to this challenge and for the roots of this problem, as a matter of fact. And in future stories, we'll be looking at solutions, and she joins us for the rest of the hour to share some of what she's found. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Last November, voters said yes to $50 million in bonds for affordable housing. The business community has anteed up an additional $50 million. That's more money than the city has ever had at their disposal to help with affordable housing in the past. It's still not enough, evidently, to meet the need. Did your interest in covering this story and the roots of this story come from that, or did it come from something else that predates all of that?
I've been interested in this issue for a while. I wrote a book that was published last fall, Money Rock, about
we talked about that.
We did on the show, about a cocaine dealer and his family in Charlotte. And I started looking at urban renewal as part of that story and found it really interesting. I've lived here for decades and didn't know very much about it, and discovered that it created quite an affordable housing crisis in the 1960s. And so when the Charlotte Journalism Collaborative organized, and this is six media in town, including WFAE, that are going to focus deeply on affordable housing and look at solutions, I pitched a story and said, hey, maybe I could do a kickoff story, kind of a big picture story, and let's look at how we got here. So I went back and kind of all the way back to the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. You call this the Groundhog Day of local issues.
Yeah.
Why? Because it keeps coming back?
Well, it was just really interesting going back and looking, in the Charlotte Observer, affordable housing stories, and it's like you just every few years you would find stories about a shortage, and there would be a task force, or there would be a big conference, and there would be promises. And you know, in 1968 there was an editorial saying this is the biggest issue our city faces.
Yeah, the Observer said adequate housing for low-income residents is perhaps the most pressing single need in Charlotte. That was 50 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in 1980, and this isn't in the story, I could have written a lot more, and the story's pretty long anyway. Ron Leeper, who was a city council member, they were discussing this problem, and he said, you know, what we really need to do is we need to have a plan, and the city needs to purchase land, and we need to sell it at a reduced cost to developers for low-income housing. And the city really still doesn't have a complete plan. They don't have metrics. They don't have a way to measure, to set goals and measure.
Well, let me be cynical about this. Are we just paying lip service to this problem? Do we really care? Or is it just too difficult to solve, really?
I mean, it is a difficult problem. But I do think there's some things that have changed. One, of course, is the social mobility ranking, 50 out of 50, that got people's attention. One is the violent protest in 2016 after the Keith Lamont Scott shooting. And this is, like, as you said, there's definitely more of a focus on this than there's ever been.
Well, there's more money.
Yeah.
Is there more focus? I mean,
well,
the city. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think there is more focus. I mean, the fact that we're sitting here talking about it for one thing, and I mean, you can find stories now in the media, you know, just about every day. But one thing that I think is really important that has changed also is I think there's a greater understanding among leaders in Charlotte about the racism and the racist roots of this problem. You know, we had Richard Rothstein come, The Color of Law. Just in the last, it was 5 years ago that Ta-Nehisi Coates published The Case for Reparations, which was a really...
You spoke yesterday on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, I listened to that.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And I think since then there's been a number of publications and people have, it has opened people's eyes, the, you know, getting woke, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I think there were conversations in the 90s when people would try to say, you know, we need to integrate South Charlotte more and get more affordable housing. And the response was, no, that's social engineering. We can't do that. I think if anybody in a public meeting said that today, there would be quite a backlash.
Well, the city council, when it was sworn in, the new city, the newest city council, mm-hmm. was a lot of young people, and they said the time for talk is over and the time for action is now. And the mayor also said that, Mayor Vial Lyles also said that, and they got the bonds passed, $50 million in bonds. It used to be $15 million in bonds every couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So this is more money at their disposal. Obviously, this is a new approach. This is a way of saying we are taking action on this. But do they face an uphill battle? Do they have? You say they don't have a plan yet.
I mean, they have some. They have a framework, and they're using some new tools. Some of this uphill battle concerns NIMBYism, the way people in Charlotte fight, a lot of neighborhoods fight when you try to build affordable housing for working people. A good example is Weddington Road. There was the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Housing Partnership has been trying for a number of years to build 70 units of, and this is for people who are working, and neighborhoods sued. It's been caught up in litigation.
Is that part of the problem, that people see affordable housing, not unlike what they may have viewed projects, housing projects as opposed to workforce housing for firemen and police officers and teachers and people who don't make enough money to live in a $500,000 home?
Yeah, I think it's complex. It has to do with people thinking that that anything that might hurt their property value, they have to fight. I mean, it's a, you know.
Would it hurt? Are there examples from elsewhere around the country where maybe they've been more successful at making a dent in their affordable housing problem? Does it hurt your property values if it is quality construction and if these are the kinds of people that go to work every day and take pride in where they live? Does it hurt your property value?
I mean, I think there's been studies that show no, it does not. And a good example is Brightwalk, which you probably know. You know, there is a number of affordable housing apartments that were built beside single-family homes, and these single-family homes have appreciated, like, more than they expected, a lot.
Which is how one builds wealth in America.
Right.
Which is part of the problem.
I mean, in this case, the single-family homes are market value, but what I'm saying is it did not hurt the value of their homes one bit.
Right. Aside from NIMBYism, there's also the problem of wage stagnation. You write that wages have been stagnant for a decade and a lot of Charlotte businesses don't pay a living wage.
Right.
You can't make them. How do you change that?
You know, I wonder, I mean, this is just me talking. I mean, I wonder if there could be some city kind of campaign
shame them into it.
Well, yeah. And there have been some big employers that have raised their wages. But I think I heard on NPR yesterday that we've gone FDR and put the minimum wage into effect in 1938. And I think in about a month, we will have gone the longest we've ever gone without a raise in the minimum wage. And, you know, many states have higher minimum wages, but we are still one of the states that has the $7.25 minimum.
I wonder what the pushback, this is off topic, but I wonder what the pushback on that is. Henry Ford, at the turn of the 20th century, knew that if he didn't pay, he had to pay the people building those Model A's and Model T's enough money that they could afford to buy a Model A or a Model T. That's how he sold the product.
Right, and I think that...
Why is that just not lesson number one in business school?
You know, what you hear is that, then we'll have to lay people off if we have to pay people more. But, I think I've read that polls show most Americans support an increase in minimum wage. Mm. And I was really taken by a column I read a while back, and it had a quote in it from a woman standing in line at Crisis Assistance Ministry. And she said, you know, really... these bus passes and these rent subsidies they're giving us, they're really subsidies for local businesses that don't pay us enough.
Right, who also advocate for lower taxes, which pays for the subsidies.
Right.
In your story, Mayor Pro Tem Julie Eisel talks about the city missing opportunities to get more affordable housing. She says there is this mentality that we should be nice to developers. There's an unwillingness to push for more. Charlotte, there are a lot of people in Charlotte who believe that if developers want something, they're going to get it, period. End of sentence, full stop. Is that unique to Charlotte?
Well, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on this, but I'm sure it's not. But it is interesting how this, and this is one of those things that people talk about, but you can't, it's really hard to, you know, prove it, to get a document. You can give anecdotal evidence. But different people, I've heard different people say things in a number of different ways. I heard a minister at a panel talk about how he hears that people say, well, you know, if we put too many requirements on these developers, they will, you know, these investors will take their money elsewhere. So there's this fear.
So?
Well, I know, but there, I think there's this fear that, you know, Charlotte wants to keep growing, wants to be big, and I feel like that's kind of
okay. So we do want to grow. We do want to be big. We have these. We're an aspirational city. We want to be Atlanta, but we don't want to be like Atlanta. We want to be all the good parts of big city without any of the bad things, which of course is impossible. But nonetheless, that's what we want. Mm-hmm. We also want to address this affordable housing problem, or at least it, people are talking about it loudly now, and publicly now. Can those two goals peacefully coexist? Can you accomplish both?
I mean, I don't see why not. It seems like we have the money in the city to do, when we want to do something, when we have the political will, it gets done.
Because part of the problem with affordable housing here and everywhere has been government policies and zoning and redlining and FHA loan approvals from the federal government. This is going way back to the 20th century. And one of the things that you brought up is that years ago, in the 1960s, they were talking about the need to acquire land for the purpose of building a workforce affordable housing on it, and that the city failed early on to acquire that land. Now they're thinking about acquiring that land and setting it aside. Can that work, or has much of the land been already gobbled up?
I still think there's a lot of land, and, you know, the city may have to pay more than it would have,
right.
But yeah, we still have a lot of land to develop.
Because in the 1960s, as I think you've already alluded to, in Second Ward, there was this thriving black community called Brooklyn, which because of urban renewal, they bulldozed with the best of intentions, I think. Maybe not. But nonetheless, they bulldozed it.
I mean, they bulldozed it because they wanted the land.
That's right. And all those people were displaced. They were thriving. They were in there. There were people in there who made lots of money and also people in there who didn't make lots of money. So it was a very well economically mixed community.
Yeah, I would say there probably weren't people that made lots of money, but there were middle class people.
They were professionals, doctors
teachers.
And dentists and teachers and people
mm-hmm.
like that. And people who needed the housing that was in that area because it was affordable in many cases, and they had to find new options. Well, now that same parcel of land is about to be redeveloped. It's the area where the government center is, around the government center, and where the aquatic center is, and where the Marshall Park is. Mm-hmm. And they want to put in a live workshop development with pocket parks.
Brooklyn Village.
Yes, how nice. How much of that's going to be set aside for affordable housing?
My memory is around 100 units.
So how much of that property, that land, is owned by the city?
I mean, the city, well, it was actually the county sold it. It's not owned by them now. They sold it to the developers.
So there was an opportunity for them to turn that into something that was affordable housing, and they didn't.
Well, I mean, I think I've talked to a county commissioner who, and I think several of them who are newer, regret that, I mean, this was a, you know, this was a deal that they were making with developers, and the developers in this case, actually, I think they tripled the number that the county had in their RFP, in their request for proposal. I think it was like 30, and they said, hey, we'll build 100. Again, the county, an example of the county not pushing for much.
So I have 30 seconds. I mean, they made a mistake. So we have 30 seconds. What's at stake here?
What is at stake? Well, I think, you know, ultimately, I mean, the people who do so many jobs in the city that we need to run the city are not going to be able to afford to live here.
And that's why the Charlotte Journalism Collaborative is taking a deep dive into this problem, and we'll continue to see stories and hear stories here and elsewhere from Pam and her colleagues on this very topic. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.